This is Taking Aim with
Rav Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, the Gaza Holocaust, Part 2, The Weapons of Genocide. The reports coming out of Gaza, despite the Israeli ban on journalists, are harrowing. Gaza hospital fills up mainly with civilians. New York Times on January 5th, the report by Tagreed al-Khadari. And it reads, the scene on Sunday at Shifa Hospital in Gaza City was a grisly reflection of the violence around it. It was both harrowing and puzzling. The casualties at Shifa on Sunday, 18 dead, hospital officials said, among a reported 30 around Gaza, were women and children and men who had been with the children. One surgeon said that he had performed 5 amputations. Quote, I don't know what kind of weapon Israel is using, said a nurse, Ziad Abid al-Jawad, 41, who had been working 24 hours without a break. There's so much amputation. Doctors have been battling to keep Shifa Hospital running under the most adverse circumstances. Sanitation workers constantly mop up blood while security officers stand guard. But scant resources are being stretched to a breaking point, and a terrible stench is in the air. Dr. Mads Gilbert, or Norwegian doctor, who was allowed into Gaza last week, had said the situation is the worst he had seen, and Dr. Gilbert has worked in many conflict zones. He reports that Shifa Hospital lacked everything: monitors, anesthesia, surgical equipment, heaters, spare parts. Israeli bombing nearly blew out all the windows. And like the rest of Gaza, the supply of fuel is limited, and the hospital must run on generators since the fuel sources have been cut by Israel to the entire Gaza Strip. There is a dispute about Gaza having electricity, but let us be clear, there is no electricity in Gaza. And now, another report that has come through, and that is another harrowing report, this time by the London Times. And this is something that we can see whenever we watch the limited reports that are coming via television, such as CNN. And that is that Israel is raining fire on Gaza with phosphorus shells, a report by Shira Frankel and Michael Evans. Israel is using controversial white phosphorus shells to screen its assault on the heavily populated Gaza Strip. The weapon that has been used by the British and U.S. forces in Iraq caused horrific burns. As the Israeli army stormed to the edges of Gaza City and the Palestinian death toll toppled 500, writes Frankel and Evans, the telltale shells can be seen spreading tentacles of thick white smoke to cover the troops' advance. Burning blobs of phosphorus cause severe injuries to anyone caught beneath them. And then let us note that the Geneva Treaty of 1980 stipulates that white phosphorus should not be used as a weapon of war in civilian areas. Charles Heyman, a military expert and former major in the British Army, said, quote, if white phosphorus was deliberately fired at a crowd of people, someone would end up in The Hague. White phosphorus is a terror weapon. The descending blobs of phosphorus will burn when contact with the skin. Right. Charles Heyman, the military expert, the former major in the British Army. But as we can see via the reports on CNN, white phosphorus is being used throughout Gaza by the Israelis. And what does it do? White phosphorus bursts into a deep yellow flame when exposed to oxygen, producing a thick white smoke. The phosphorus burns are almost always second or third degree because the particles do not stop burning on contact with skin until they have entirely disappeared. It's not unknown for them to reach the bone, and they cannot be put out by water. Israel previously used white phosphorus during its war in Lebanon in 2006 and has admitted having done so. We saw the use of white phosphorus in Lebanon by the Israelis during its bombardment in 1982, and every single one of the victims there died. It has been used frequently by the British and U.S. forces, as I mentioned, notably in Iraq in 2003. White phosphorus has the slang name Willie Pete, and it dates from the First World War and was commonly used in Vietnam, again by the United States. Today on Taking Aim, we are going to have a conversation with James Brooks. James is from Vermonters for a Just Peace in Palestine, Israel. He is the webmaster for this significant anti-war organization. But James has another role. James has done extensive writing about U.S.-supplied weaponry used by the Israelis in Gaza, the West Bank, and Lebanon, and particularly the GBU-39, the new small bunker buster bomb, and the genotoxic weapons such as DIME, the DIME bomb technology, the dense inert metal explosive. Ralph?
Well, my James Brooks has been the most thorough and definitive articulator of the nature of the weaponry of genocide that the Israelis have specialized in deploying against the people of Palestine, not only with respect to the genotoxic weapons and the chemical weapons and the particular technology that DIME represents, but also with respect to poison gas. To the variety of gases and poison gas in particular, about which he has done a definitive report. James has been doing these reports and preparing a whole arsenal of data and information, the most exhaustive encyclopedic, comprehensive examination of the weaponry and the methods and the underlying politics, indeed, of the Israeli assault. For year after year, and it's really a pleasure to have James with us today. We have, as listeners to Take Aim will know, we've done a series of reports on this subject, always referring to the articles and the studies that he has done. Jamie, I'm so glad to have you with us. Welcome to Taking Aim.
Thank you, Ralph, and thank you, Maya. It's good to talk to you again.
You know, James, references here to the weaponry, we were discussing just this, the GBU-39s and what is entailed here. Could you describe this for our listeners?
Sure. And before we get to that, I just wanted to follow up Maya's excellent report on the use of white phosphorus again by the Israeli Defense Forces. And I just wanted to point out that there are commercially available from a number of defense manufacturers screening smoke canisters that can be used in place of white phosphorus for screening combat movement. Some of these canisters are quite large, and they produce copious amounts of smoke in various colors. Select your own. So that's what they're specifically for screening combat operations from the enemy or from civilian view. There's no need anymore to use white phosphorus for screening operations. It's obsolete. The only reason today to use white phosphorus would be to exploit its terroristic capabilities.
And one of the features of white phosphorus is that water, so far from extinguishing it, extenuates its reach. So, and once white phosphorus hits flesh, it continues to eat and eat right down to the bone. Water is not a method of removal, but rather of acceleration.
Right. I was just reading Robert Fisk reminiscing about Beirut in 1982 and how babies in the morgue were shown to him, and when the drawers were pulled out, the babies caught fire just being exposed to the air.
Well, Jamie, you know, in Beirut, as you No, the hospitals were all targeted and hit, so much that so that the Al-Hut Theological Center had to be converted into a field hospital in the middle of Beirut. And there people were brought in, and we were present when they were brought in, all of them victims of white phosphorus. I just want to mention that, it's an unspeakable scene to see the suppurating flesh and the terrified eyes of the victims, and there is no survival. The International Committee of the Red Cross was present, and I saw one of the officers of the Red Cross there, and I walked up to him and I said, "What are you people going to do about this white phosphorus?" And he looked at me and he said, "What white phosphorus?" He was looking. I said, "You're looking at a victim right here." He says, "I don't know that that's white phosphorus." I said, "Just a moment." I said, "Dr. El-Sharif, would you come over and describe this?" Immediately, this International Committee of the Red Cross figure walked off, wouldn't even wait to talk to the doctor. Of course, not a single reference by the ICRC to the deployment of white phosphorus or other of the weaponry that the Israelis were using, saturating Beirut and the Palestinian camps across Lebanon.
Jamie, I'd like you to describe the GBU-39, which is a small diameter bomb. It's little over 250 pounds. Again, one of these smart bombs, these bunker buster bombs. And I was reading that it has the same penetration as a one-ton bomb. That is, it can penetrate 6 feet of reinforced concrete. In other words, bring down an entire building, as it has been doing in Gaza. And it was only in September that on DefenseTalk.com they were announcing that Israel was acquiring the GBU-39, the small diameter bomb, and that Congress had been notified about the military sale of the GBU-39. This was in September, and already they have been delivered and are being used in Gaza.
Correct. The Congress was given a 30-day option to block the sale that was proposed by the Defense Department, and of course Congress did not see any reason to block that sale. 1,000 of these new generation GBU-39 bombs were sold to Israel. And the GBU-39, the prime contractor is Boeing, the McDonnell Douglas division. It is not actually the equivalent in penetrating power of a one-ton bunker buster, but it's similar. The numbers have been used somewhat fancifully, but defense people will tell you that it cannot blow up a whole building the way a one-ton bunker buster can, and it can't penetrate the same depth of reinforced concrete. But it is a highly efficient little bomb. The reason that the United States Air Force is so excited about the addition of the GBU-39 to its arsenal, and this is, I underline, a U.S. Air Force project, the Small Diameter Bomb Project, part of the Focused Lethality Munitions Project, is that with these bombs, which weigh about 285 pounds strapped to the plane, they can put 8 bombs on an F-16 or an F-15 or an F-22 or an F-35, whereas they can only affix 1 one-ton bomb or 2 half-ton bombs. So with this small profile bomb, they're able to improve their kills per sortie ratio. And this is what they talk about, that it makes these jet fighter bombers, much more efficient as killing machines. At the same time, the GBU-39 is presented in a public profile as a low collateral damage weapon. This is a weapon that with a reduced blast radius that will cause fewer collateral injuries and casualties than comparable blast fragmentation bombs. Okay? Now, the GBU-39, as it's currently constructed, is a hybrid. It's going towards this low collateral damage profile, but it's not there yet. It's 6 feet long. It's about 7.5 inches in diameter. It's made out of hardened steel. And it has a tritonal explosive payload, about 250-pound payload. It's almost all explosive power. The fact is that even though they claim that these things are better suited for urban warfare, what they are going to do, as we've already seen in Gaza, is vastly increase the killing capacity of whatever Air Force chooses to use them. They are GPS-guided, that is, through the satellite GPS system. It's possible to enter coordinates for a GPS location and set it and forget it, they say, so that it can be programmed on the plane and then released, and it will find its target within a certain range of accuracy. However, what they don't tell you when they're crowing about how unbelievably accurate this thing is, they don't tell you that the targeting system has a built-in inaccuracy, which prevents the thing from even being considered by the military a precision weapon. There are, because of the set-it-and-forget-it and technicalities about the way the GPS system works, it's not terribly accurate. So you could shoot it at a given house, but it's just as likely to hit the house next to it on either side. It's only accurate to within about 30 to 40 feet, and that's not a precision weapon.
Well, now, Jamie, one of the characteristics of these small-diameter bombs with enhanced lethality is that they have certain components, and those components are related to the extraordinary number of amputations that are being reported from the hospitals and by the doctors of of the victims. In fact, in the New York Times account, I believe it was today, almost everybody brought in had required an amputation, particularly the women. And the report in the New York Times has the doctors, I'm looking for the citation, but I'll paraphrase it for now, saying that we've never seen so many amputations. And, of course, this has been a feature of the particular type of tungsten and other metallic components, is it not, that you have described?
Very much so. And I can't be sure, and I think everyone should be aware that when we look at the publicly released information about these weapons, particularly about the new generation weapons, and, you know, this is nothing new, really, but this is the current situation, it's quite possible that we're not getting the full story, because when Israel undertook a 5 months of intensive warfare against Gaza in 2006, this was initially simultaneous with the war on Lebanon in 2006, but it extended for months following the end of the war on Lebanon. This destructive period in Gaza, which killed hundreds of civilians, was one of the features of these attacks was the extremely high rate of amputations reported by medics and doctors helping the wounded. Very high rate of post-injury death. There was a very poor survival rate during these this period of Israeli raids. And what an Italian television team with scientific researchers discovered was that the tissues of many of the victims had unusually high concentrations of heavy metals. And most significant among these metals were tungsten, copper, lighter metals like carbon and aluminum in high quantities. And a doctor at the University of Parma in Italy concluded that the best guess was that Israel was already using a weapon system developed by the U.S. Air Force called the Dense Inert Metal Explosive Bomb, which we call the DIME bomb, D-I-M-E. And that was consistent with the tissue samples and also consistent with the types of injuries. There were many injuries where people, children, people in their sleep, were died with perforation wounds all over their bodies. Heavy implantation, apparently, of some type of powder in the skin. And people with extremely severe injuries to the limbs that were very disfiguring. And this was undoubtedly one of the reasons for the extremely high amputation rates during 2006, which, I underline, we're hearing again today. Now, the dime bomb was not publicly slated to be released for use until 2008 by the United States Air Force in Iraq. But given the high level of cooperation between the United States Air Force and the Israeli Air Force, and given the unique profile of the injuries and tissue samples, the best, most plausible explanation of what was going on in 2006 is that the Israelis were given this batch of dime bombs to use, probably on a test basis, for the U.S. Air Force, the first experimental use. So when we see now these extremely high rates of amputations, and we look at the GBU-39, 1,000 of which were recently delivered to Israel, and we know by Israel's own admission that they're using the GBU-39, furthermore, we know that the Department of Defense in the United States in 2006 funded the extension of the GBU-39 project to incorporate the dime bomb into the GBU-39. And that is slated for first testing this year, 2009, by the U.S. Air Force. So it's quite possible that some of the GBU-39s that the Israeli Air Force has today are in fact dime weapons.
Well, Jamie, you know, in the defense talk article of September 11th, 2008, it describes how the Defense Security Cooperation Agency notified Congress of a foreign military sale to Israel of GPU-39 small diameter bombs, as well as associated equipment and services. And what's interesting about this is that it states that implementation will involve multiple trips to Israel by United States government and contractor representatives for 1 week intervals for approximately 3 years.
Exactly.
They're preparing, obviously and clearly, for this onslaught.
And, Jamie, in talking about the U.S. supply of weapons with Israel, there's a very close relationship between Israel and the United States, where many of the Israeli manufacturers develop the component parts of the U.S. fighter jets. They work hand in hand.
That's right.
So the F-16 fighter jet and the missiles that have been used by Israel are supplied in total, the final product, by the U.S., but many of the components are made in Israel. In addition to that, the U.S. transferred more than $200 million worth of spare parts for the F-16 between 2001 and 2006. And in July of last year, 2008, the United States gave Israel 186 million gallons of JP-8, that's the aviation jet fuel, in order to fly these planes. And the U.S. signed a $1.3 billion contract whereby Raytheon was transferring to Israel thousands of the TOW, the Hellfire, and again, other types of bunker busters aside from the ones that McDonnell Douglas Boeing has been supplying. So this is a very close relationship. What we saw in 1982, as reported by Jane's, the defense magazine in Great Britain that carefully monitors all the munitions supplies and weapons development, Jane's had reported that for the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, that the U.S. was actually testing its new fighter jets. It had supplied it to Israel before the United States was even using it. And that the Israel invasion of Lebanon was a test case for those fighter jets.
Yeah, a pretty bad test. Robert Fisk found later that the Israeli pilots were finding their targets by flying over Beirut at 500 miles per hour, looking at photographs of the target zone.
Well, Jamie, one of the things you mentioned to us when we were discussing this before was that the F-15, F-16, and in fact F-22 supplied by the U.S. can glide 68 miles. And a lot of these launchings occur while the aircraft are over Israel, which explains why so many in Gaza report, as you said, that the bomb attacks come out of the blue. There's no warning. There's no sound of aircraft. There's no indication for the population that anything is occurring when suddenly these weapons are upon them. And you describe them as carrying a mixture of TNT, aluminum power, and aluminum powder, generating enormous high shock waves. They burst asunder structures, but they also have an incredible impact on the internal organ system of the people who are in their way.
And that's what I'd like you to talk about. You led us to some very important articles, and I was reading one from globalsecurity.org that is specific about the types of injuries that come from explosives, and they talk about two types of explosives, high-order explosives, which would be the explosives from these Bunker Buster GBU-39 bombs, and then low-order explosives, which are the IEDs, such as the handmade weapons used by militants. But for these high-order explosives, they talk about the blast injuries that are characterized by anatomical and physical changes from overpressurization force impacting the body's surface. And I was wondering if you could address this.
James, you did a three-part series of great import on targeting DNA in Gaza, the dime bomb, genotoxic weapons. Could you address these issues as you did?
Let me clarify what we were just talking about. The 68-mile glide path, that refers to the standoff range of the GBU-39 bomb, not to the individual aircraft that can launch it. And I don't believe that Israel has any F-22s or at least no significant number. But they do have F-16s and F-15s, and now they're just starting to get the F-35s. And that goes to what Maya was talking about the intense level of cooperation and joint development by the United States Air Force and the Israeli Defense Forces. It's my impression that level of integration and co-development is increasing pretty dramatically, and that we're going to see more of these joint developments and even joint deployments, just as Israel is also now doing joint deployments and exercises, military exercises with NATO. So let's keep that in mind, because where the U.S. goes, I think increasingly that's where we're going to see Israel going in terms of the armamentarium. Now, the 68-mile standoff range of the GBU-39, what does that mean? That means that an F-16 flying over Israel, say over Tel Aviv, could release a GBU-39 from under its wing, and that GBU-39 could find its way to a target in the Gaza Strip, so that the people in the target area would have no warning at all of the oncoming bomb. They probably wouldn't even hear any significant bomb noise, because that bomb would be gliding with pop-out wings. These bombs, each one is a pop-out wing assembly and can be set to glide or not glide, or to glide for a period of time and then stop gliding so that it then reaccelerates and it hits its target with more force. These bombs can also be set to airburst, in other words, not to hit the target, but to explode in the air somewhat above the target, which is a really devastating area anti-personnel weapon. And I've seen video of these bombs in airburst mode, and it's quite frightening. They produce a very dense, very hot shower of slugs for, I'd estimate, a 200-foot radius. So when they talk about these things as being low collateral damage weapons, it's entirely the way it's used. And like I say, by multiplying the force capacity of each fighter bomber 4 to 8 times, they're actually vastly increasing its killing power. Now, when we talk about the dime bomb, this is what we're trying to get to when we're talking about the GBU-39. Are some of these dime bomb-fitted GBU-39s? We don't know. What is the dime bomb? It is an extension of the U.S. Air Force's work on depleted uranium. And that work on depleted uranium stretches back into the 1960s and really conceptually back to World War II. Depleted uranium was a massive byproduct of the U.S. Nuclear program. Depleted uranium is an extremely hard and extremely dense metal, ideally suited for making penetrating warheads.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, the Gaza Holocaust Part 2, The Weapons of Genocide. We're having a conversation with James Brook, the webmaster and also an author of many important works on Israeli weaponry. He is the webmaster for Vermonters for a Just Peace in Palestine, Israel. James, you were talking about depleted uranium before our station ID.
Right. The Israelis have been using depleted uranium, or were using depleted uranium during the 1980s pretty heavily, both in Lebanon and in the occupied territories. They said in the late 80s that they were ceasing the use of depleted uranium. Norwegian medics just told 2 days ago Press TV, a global press outlet, that they had detected traces of depleted uranium in the tissues of victims of Israel's most recent onslaught in Gaza. That would be consistent with Israel's use of the GBU-28, which was a one-ton depleted uranium bunker buster bomb, 100 of which were sold to Israel in 2006 by the United States. Dr. Douglas Rocky, the former chief of the U.S. Army Depleted Uranium Project for Medical Affairs, who has since said that depleted uranium needs to be completely removed from the world's armamentarium, that it is a vicious radiological weapon with no safe use, pointed out that the GBU-28 sold to Israel in 2006 could very well produce these kinds of injuries that we're now hearing about from Press TV occurring in Gaza.
Well, James, if I could just mention that in Al Jazeera on December 5th, 2006, you wrote part one, U.S. and Israel targeting DNA in Gaza, the dime bomb, yet another genotoxic weapon. When you addressed these very issues and you described DIME as an LCD, a low collateral damage weapon developed in the U.S. Air Force Research Lab, slated for initial deployment in 2008, and you describe how it produces an unusually powerful blast within a relatively small area, spraying a superheated micro shrapnel of powdered heavy metal tungsten alloy, chemically toxic, damaging the immune system, rapidly causing cancer, and attacking DNA.
Correct.
Could you, and in fact, your article, which is extraordinary, cites the firsthand reports of Dr. Jomar Al-Saka, the chief of the emergency unit at Al-Shifa, Gaza's largest hospital, who describes the one-on-one, appearance of these results in internal soft tissue injuries. It's harrowing. Quote, when the shrapnel hits the body, it causes very strong burns that destroy the tissues around the bones. It burns and destroys internal organs like the liver, kidneys, and the spleen and other organs, and makes saving the wounded almost impossible.
Mm-hmm.
As a surgeon, I've seen thousands of wounds during the Intifada, but nothing was like this weapon.
Mm-hmm. Now, This is the product of DU research. This came out of the DU program. It's really the same bunch of people and the same conceptual project in the U.S. military. Depleted uranium grew in public disfavor during the 1990s and has been suggested by many as being one of the prime culprits in Gulf War syndrome, afflicting hundreds of thousands of U.S. GIs. It has been fingered for the horrible birth defects, cancers, and leukemias, and incredible rates in bomb zone areas in Iraq and Afghanistan. And the U.S. military documents, it's very clear from 1990 forward in the public, that the U.S. military saw a need to replace depleted uranium with something else. What they have selected as that something else is this heavy metal tungsten alloy, which we'll call HMTA. Heavy metal tungsten alloy has a very similar toxicity profile to depleted uranium. And some people would scratch their heads at this because tungsten is not a radioactive material, whereas uranium is. But the little-known fact about depleted uranium is that the bulk of its toxicity profile is due not to its radioactivity, but to its function as a heavy metal, an extremely toxic heavy metal. The Air Force Radiological Research Laboratory has been working on testing this HMTA by itself and in comparison to depleted uranium since the year 2000. And they have shown in at least five separate studies with five different objects of interest. In other words, not replicating the same study over and over again, but progressively proceeding through the toxicological profile of this HMTA tungsten alloy. And they have elucidated that in every way it's tested, it performs very similarly to depleted uranium, except that it's much more carcinogenic than depleted uranium is. When rats given four tiny little particles, tiny little pellets of this HMTA in their leg muscles, they all depleted, 100%, developed cancer within 3 months, and they were all dead within 6 months. That's 100% carcinogenesis. The rats in the study given similar levels of DU developed little or no cancer. There were other studies by the same group that showed high rates of cancer from the tungsten alloy, very low rates of cancer from depleted uranium. Then they tested, would depleted tungsten alloy pass its genetic damage down through the generations as depleted uranium does? Answer, yes. It's about 70% as effective as depleted uranium in causing cancers and genetic damage in the unborn that are identical to those suffered by the parent. There were other studies that showed that it was highly immunotoxic. In other words, this tungsten alloy damages and suppresses the activity of the immune system. It's also found to generate leukemia, just as depleted uranium does. And all of these studies were implanting tiny bits of this tungsten alloy in the body tissue of experimental animals. Why were they doing that? Because that's exactly how they intend to use it. Because that's what the dime bomb is. It uses extremely finely powdered tungsten alloy as its shrapnel. This is a leap forward from what the cluster bomb technology that we're all familiar with. But this is an anti-personnel weapon that goes beyond the cluster bomb because it uses this extremely toxic powder as its shrapnel, not fine bits of metal. And because of that, they claim that it's a low collateral damage weapon because the powder blast usually only extends about in a 25-foot radius, okay? It means if it hits a small house, it can damage, you know, and if it's part of a GBU-39, it's going to destroy the whole house. But it's also going to kill every single person in the house with this toxic powder. So that's the short story of the toxicology of the dime weapon.
You had mentioned
what's striking is that it's, you know, this was what was supposed to replace, and this same alloy, I should point out, is also being used in hardened form in casings for where they would use depleted uranium as a shell casing. They now want to use this tungsten alloy as a shell casing. And, of course, when these shell casings hit things and the tungsten alloy powderizes, just as the DU does, although it's not pyrophoric, the powder will get into the environment and cause extreme environmental damage as well, because tungsten in itself, not even in this extremely toxic alloy, tungsten in itself is an environmental contaminant that leaves land barren, gets into the water supply, and travels readily through the biota.
Well, you know, I want to reference here, as you had indicated, James, that speaking for the moment of depleted uranium, one of the consequences is that in the powdered form, it permeates the air, it permeates the water, it permeates the soil, it gets into the food supply. There's been an epidemic of thalidomide-like deformities in Iraq and now Afghanistan. And in your part two on the dime bomb, yet another genotoxic weapon, you mentioned that the dime bombs blast a superheated micro shrapnel of powdered heavy metal tungsten alloy, HMTA, and the studies indicate that the HMTA embedded in the body disrupt biochemistry, rapidly cause cancer, and like depleted uranium, HMTA is genotoxic and capable of inflicting genetic mutations.
And I want to point out, Ralph, that my most recent research on this leads me to think that the fix is in for a cover-up on this research.
Mm-hmm.
Because the all of this research has been rebranded by the Department of Defense since I did my investigation in 2006. It's now all republished as having been performed under the auspices of the Henry M. Jackson Military Medical Research Facility, when actually it was performed by the Air Force Radiological Research Institute.
Mm-hmm.
And the two most recent abstracts from this group are about a new project begun in 2007 to investigate the toxicology of tungsten alloy, just like they were starting it all over again from what they began in 2000. And then a follow-up abstract released early this year, which said that no progress had been made because they had not been able to get samples of the material to test, but that now all the animals had been successfully implanted as of May 2008, and no adverse reactions had been noted to date.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this wouldn't be consistent with any of the prior research, because all of the prior research showed very early onset of adverse reactions. And the idea that they weren't able to access the material is absurd, because there's almost a dozen other abstracts from the Aberdeen Proving Grounds and other military installations during the last 2 years, testing the same tungsten alloy for all kinds of ballistics purposes.
So,
obviously, there's plenty of material available. The weapons project is in full sail. It's my estimation from looking at what they're testing that they're very interested in using this and expanding its uses. Yet the medical research is now being hamstrung, and it looks like it's about to be shunted off into a new study that will probably say there was a negative result. And in the history of fraudulent science, one negative result study can be flogged for 10 years to find out why, all the time ignoring all the positive results.
So, James, what you're talking about in the long-term effect and even in the short-term effect of the dime weaponry and this use of the tungsten, the heavy metals, is yet another aspect, an aspect that isn't covered by global security when it talks about the high-order explosive injuries. And I want to go back to some of the things that people are seeing on their TV screens, because and what's happening in the hospitals from these blast injuries, these high-order explosives of these bunker buster bombs. And that is the blast lung. It talks about blowing up your lungs from the overpressurization wave. Secondarily, they say there's the flying debris, and not only the bomb fragments, which with these new dime bombs are gaseous as opposed to other bombs where you have actually flying steel fragments.
They're not gaseous, okay? There's no gas involved.
Oh, it's particles, excuse me.
Right, very, very,
very
dense,
fine particles.
Very dense particles with ejected at extreme blast force. So extreme that the first attempts to measure the blast force of the dime bomb failed because it destroyed the equipment. They had to fashion new equipment in order to understand the blast force of the dime bomb.
So these very fine particles, as opposed to what people were used to before with cluster bombs where you have steel fragments, here you have these fine particles. But these also penetrate and cause this severe damage that's requiring amputation. And as has been noted, most of the people who are coming in injured will die. Then they have the tertiary results when they talk about these high-pressure explosives. That is people being blown by the high-pressure wind, and that causes fractures and brain injuries. And a fourth is the burns, particularly from the phosphorus and crushing injuries. But what they don't discuss and what you're discussing are the long-term effects of what it means when you use these heavy metal bombs in the area.
Right. And that's, unfortunately, I think, you know, this is the future that's right around the corner, that much higher incidence of shockwave injuries, just like we've seen among veterans in Iraq, that the new injury is the the brain injury that's not diagnosed in theater, but when you get home, you finally realize that you suffered permanent brain damage from shockwave injuries. This, I'm afraid, is going to become much more prevalent in the Palestinian territories because of Israel's use of these new weapons. I think also one thing we should understand is that with the GBU-39, they now have the ultimate surprise attack weapon. There's no reason these weapons can't be used anytime they want to perform a surprise assassination, and it's utterly risk-free for Israel because the soldiers or aviators who are involved don't have to be anywhere near the action.
Jamie, one point about this. Mm-hmm. As we read in the reports in today's New York Times, in yesterday's USA Today, in the Guardian in London, in the Times of London, the hospital accounts, the reports of the victims and the families of the victims, the reports of the doctors. You wrote on December 6, 2006, horrific wounds in Gaza may be the warfare of the future.
Right.
And you say DIME is part of the Air Force's focused lethality munitions program. And you describe it in terms of Israel's new weapon, and it, quote, slices off its victim's legs, leaving signs of heat and burns near the point of amputation. It's as if a saw was used to cut through the bone, according to Dr. Habas Al-Wahid, head of the emergency room at Gaza's Shuhada Al-Aqsa Hospital.
These are the dramatic effects.
And you mentioned, Jamie, photographs of the living and dead Palestinian victims, many of whom are children. We notice patches of darkened but unburned skin where metal powder was driven into and or through the skin by blast force. A child's torso is peppered with holes, some of which, judging from doctors' reports, probably tunnel through to exit wounds in the back.
Right.
And, I mean, the harrowing account is at 1-to-1. Very similar to the reports in the newspapers in these current days about what is occurring in the hospitals in Gaza.
And Ralph, let's make clear, this is a primary reason why the Zionists are refusing, despite the ruling of the Israeli Supreme Court, to allow journalists into Gaza.
Yeah, they ignore their Supreme Court routinely. This is so old, it's not funny. I wanted to point out that in addition to these dramatic injuries, these acute injuries that we see in the hospitals, the doctors in Gaza in 2006 were reporting something else as well, that they would frequently stabilize a patient who had experienced some of these injuries that we now think were probably dime-related, and then they would send them home. But the people would come right back 2 days later, sicker than they had been when they left. That there was a steady deterioration, and then the people would die within a week. And the doctors wouldn't even be able to understand the cause of death. Okay? Now this reminds us of the severe immunotoxicity of the dime bomb. And also its capacity for insidious, hidden, occult, internal injuries that you could be afflicted by this and not know it and be dead within a week. This is the kind of thing that they're using. I agree, it's quite possible that the dime bomb is back and in use in Gaza today. What we do know for sure is that the GBU-39 is in place, and that, you know, last night on the back of the envelope, I did a list of weapons that are in use now and a list of weapons that we could expect in the foreseeable future. And I'd just like to relate those to you.
Yes, please.
Israel using, Israel's banned experimental and or toxic weaponry from 1948, and this is just a short list. White phosphorus, bulldozers, of course, the whole nuclear program, up to 300 to 400 nuclear warheads. Depleted uranium shells of all sizes. Cluster bombs by the millions. Poison gases of all sorts, and we haven't even touched on that yet.
No, and I want to mention here for our listeners, because this is one of the most extraordinary documents that you've done, Jamie, the Israeli poison gas attacks that Media Monitor published on, I believe it was February 18th, 2001, and it's prophetic, and it's also, it's the most definitive description of the array of toxic gases, poison gases, nerve gases that have been unleashed.
Right. Also, flechette shells, the wide-area anti-personnel weapons fired from Israeli tanks that shower thousands of razor-sharp flechettes over a wide area and have been used to kill crowds in the occupied territories. The GBU-28, the bunker buster, that's emblematic of a class of bunker busters that Israel has access to, but we know that Israel has GBU-28s, which are one-ton depleted uranium bombs. The dime bomb, it's a very solid guess that Israel has the dime bomb, the GBU-39. Now, moving forward, we expect to see a lot more use of air power, because we see that they can use air power without any military risk whatsoever. The F-35, that's the new jet fighter that was developed by the Joint Strike Task Force. And here again, the level of interaction and cooperation between Israel and the U.S. Air Force. Israel was a charter member of the Joint Strike Task Force with the United Kingdom. And these countries worked together to create the F-35. And the F-35 is very much according to Israel's requirements for urban warfare. Larger and smaller unmanned aerial vehicles. Israel is a world leader in producing UAVs for military use. Now, I expect to see soon heavy metal tungsten alloy shells and heavy metal tungsten alloy ammunition. The Merkava tank will be phased out and replaced with a much more robust tank that will probably be much more impervious to rocket-propelled grenades, which were so effective when Hezbollah used them. Space surveillance will include infrared, visible, and electromagnetic radio surveillance. Nanoweapons, and the dime bomb is actually a representative of the new class of nanoweapons that are in development. The dime bomb uses nanotechnology in the manufacturing of the powder. Directed energy defense weapons. Israel is, as Rafael Industries, is Israel's lead corporation in developing energetic weapons for military use, and they are working on a microwave-related kind of dome that they hope to build that will prevent rocket fire from reaching targets in southern Israel. Directed energy weapons, that's use of microwaves and other forms of electromagnetic energy as weapons in a military sense.
Right, we call it the people zapper.
Well, right, specifically, you know, and then we'll go to crowd control. Now, those are just the military pieces. Crowd control, we have the rubber-covered steel bullets, we have death by tear gas, documented numerous times in Israeli operations, tear gas canisters used as projectiles, then the poison gases, the stun grenades. This is just crowd control. This is just to suppress nonviolent demonstrations. Stun grenades, horses, bulldozers, pepper spray, bean bags, burning sticky rings. That was an Israeli innovation in the last few years. The blue ooze that they have been spraying on international solidarity movement demonstrations. The stench, also called the skunk, which is deployed by a machine, which is a liquid stench that lasts for a week. The scream, which is a new high-frequency, extremely high-decibel sound generator that makes it impossible to stay in the area. And the next step will be the deployment of what the U.S. military already has, which is the millimeter wave denial of area weapon. That's the people zapper that increases skin temperature to an unbearable pain within a couple of seconds of exposure. There's no doubt that Israel will be using that. Israel already uses millimeter wave technology in some of the weapon scanners that they have in checkpoints distributed around the West Bank. Those have been sometimes erroneously referred to as X-ray machines, but they actually use millimeter wave technology in the same way that airports use it.
James, I'm sorry I'm going to have to cut you off because our time is up for today, and we've really appreciated having you here, and I recommend that people Google, you know, look for articles by you on the internet, James
Brooks. I could give you
Brooks.
A simple web address, Maya.
Yes,
please,
would please you,
do
please.
That. Please do that, Jamie.
That would get people to everything that we've been talking about and the references. And that would be VTJP, that's VT as in Vermont, JP as in Just Peace, .org/report. That's the word report, lowercase. And that will get you on a page about Israel's chemical weapons.
Well,
that's great.
Thanks, James. And I'd like to end by saying that there are going to be large demonstrations around the world. Please look for the demonstration near you in Sakhalin within Israel, the Zionist state. 100,000 people of the 1.4 million Israeli Arab, that is Palestinians with Israeli citizenship, demonstrate, the largest demonstration since October 2000. And there have been demonstrations throughout the world, in Paris, in London, in the freezing temperatures of Berlin, Dusseldorf, Frankfurt, in Salzburg, Austria, in Madrid, in Ankara, Turkey, in Athens, Greece, Cyprus, Lebanon, Jordan, Syria, across the United States, Amsterdam, Netherlands, Malmö and Uppsala, Sweden, Oslo, Norway, you name the country, and there have been demonstrations in Pakistan and throughout Asia. Please demonstrate this Saturday. Look for the demonstration near you. This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Gaza Holocaust, Part 2, The Weapons of Genocide. Please visit the website that James Brook gave you. There'll be a link on our website, www.takingaimradio.com. Next week, join us when we have Hamdi Faraj talking about the demonstrations and the resistance of the Palestinians. Wow, big, 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 big,